Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Aziz Huq, a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He is a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aziz Huq.
Hi, Ian. Thank you for having me back.
And yesterday I spoke with Shahid Bhattar, the head of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, and he gave a fairly alarming account of what the president has now agreed not to veto in terms of the military authorization bill. Apparently the president is satisfied with the revisions that have been made or the compromises. I thought, based upon what Shahid had said to me yesterday, that this would be a front-page story today. There's nothing in the LA Times about it at all, and there's a page 26 article in the New York Times about it. So I'm quite puzzled as to whether me and our audience should still be alarmed that the First, the Fifth, and the Sixth Amendment have been shredded by the Congress.
Ian, I think there's a complex story here, and maybe it's helpful to remind your readers about what's really at issue here. What's at issue is whether and how the government can employ military detention instead of the ordinary criminal process that it uses when it detains someone for a long duration. And the difference pertains to all of the rights that you identified. The government might be able to use military detention on the basis of the exercise of First Amendment rights. And when it engages in the detention, it's fairly clear that it doesn't need to give an opportunity to the detained person to defend themselves with the same procedural rigors that are available in the ordinary criminal process. So this is a pretty consequential question. And the National Defense Authorization Act raises the question because it contains two provisions that, on the one hand, describe the scope of when military detention is permissible, and on the other hand, seem to suggest that there are some instances in which military detention is not just permissible, but mandatory. And early versions of that bill seem to extend not just the availability of military detention, but the mandatory nature of its use into the United States to allow the president or the executive branch to detain people without the rigors of due process, even within the United States. And so that's the kind of basic concern. I think that's a real and significant issue. It's a very, very important question of sort of basic entitlement. And I think the reason that the bill, it's still a bill, it's not a law yet, hasn't hit the front pages of the New York Times, as you say, is that it's really ambiguous what effect the bill has on the president's military lockup power. And here it's helpful to know that even today, before the bill is passed, there is case law in at least one federal circuit, which encompasses, I believe, four or five states, that allows the government to lock up citizens in military detention without using the criminal process. So there's at least a colorable argument that that authority already exists today under existing law. And then it's not entirely clear from the face of the bill whether or how it changes the scope of that authority. One of the consequences of the congressional fights over the bill is that the language of both provisions is really quite unclear. And I think that it is quite plausible to say that given the overwhelmingly important constitutional concerns that this area raises, of the kind that I just alluded to, one ought to read that ambiguity narrowly. One ought to read the bills narrowly to not extend this power. And essentially, that's the basis upon which the president has declined to veto the bills. He says, look, you know, you don't need to read these as effectuating massive changes to the law. But of course, that's this president, right? And it may be that down the road we have a president who is more willing to aggressively read ambiguous statutes, and that that's going to generate a different outcome.
Well, I'm reminded, Aziz Haq, of the Second Amendment, which I thought was fairly clear. And recently the Supreme Court turned that on its head, where the predicate was ignored and the second part was accepted as the dominant reality. So is that an example of how things can be reinterpreted?
Yeah, it is. It's relatively rare that constitutional language is subject to that kind of dramatic change. Although we may see a dramatic change in the reading of what's called the Commerce Clause when the Supreme Court takes up the healthcare case next year. It's reasonably common for there to be pretty radical changes in the interpretation of the language of statutes, either by the executive branch or courts over time. And there's lots and lots of examples of this from really quite important areas. This has happened with Title VII of the Civil Rights Act that starts off being interpreted one way. Courts take it and interpret it a very different way. The executive takes different positions over time. It happens quite famously with the Clean Air Act, which is initially interpreted quite broadly, and then the Reagan administration comes along and says, no, it doesn't mean as much as you think it means. It means something very, very narrow. You saw the same kind of dispute arising over whether the EPA can regulate carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases a couple of years ago. So the idea that there are ambiguous statutes and the idea that the government will radically change its interpretation of an ambiguous statute with changing partisan administrations is actually pretty common. It happens a lot.
So this kind of Talmudic behavior is par for the course then, Aziz Haq. Although,
well, it's very hard to write laws that are entirely clear and that eliminate all possibilities for
ambiguity
or the exercise of troubling discretion by the government.
But I thought in this case, though, Aziz, given that what's at stake,
yep,
based upon the interview yesterday with Shahid Bhattar, the Posse Comitatus Act is out, the First Amendment is up for grabs, the Fifth and the Sixth. Now, if that's the case, then the ambiguity is not appropriate, surely, when there's so much at stake.
Yeah, I agree on the merits with Shahid Bhattar. I guess I would say that if you cast your mind back to the authorization for the use of military force that was enacted on September the 18th, 2001, if you look closely at the language of that, it's pretty ambiguous. It might be taken to authorize large uses of military force in the continental United States. And it wasn't interpreted that way, by and large, with a couple of important exceptions in the past decade. But just notice that statutory ambiguity has been available for a decade already, right? So it's not this. I think that this new measure and the NDA is a very bad thing because it deepens that ambiguity and it has this, I think, really pernicious idea that the criminal justice system can't deal with terrorism cases, which is an idea that essentially Republicans in Congress have conjured up post-2008 as a partisan stick to beat President Obama with. They just didn't think of this in the 7 years preceding that. They didn't criticize President Bush for using the criminal justice system in a vast number of cases, right? This is an argument that has almost no factual predicates behind it. It's an argument that is almost entirely partisan. And one of the troubling things about this, the NDAA, is that it gives some credence to it. It gives some, gives some sense that this is not a utterly specious argument.
in terms of the lineup of those who were afraid that the bill went too far. You had Defense Secretary Panetta, CIA Director David Petraeus, FBI Director Mueller, National Intelligence Director James Clapper, White House Advisor to Counterterrorism John Brennan, Department of Justice National Security Head Lisa Monaco, and then you had the President weighing in personally. So did Hillary Clinton. And on the Republican side, it seems that the bill was being pushed by John McCain and Lindsey Graham. Apparently, former Vice President Dick Cheney briefed the Republican caucus on it. When you mentioned earlier that it's really more of a political issue, Aziz Haq, I'm reminded that it was Karl Rove who said that the Republicans deal with terrorism by putting them in Guantanamo, and Democrats want to give terrorists therapy. So that, you think that's kind of an element that's infected this debate?
Well, I think that it's fairly clear and not particularly controversial to say that the Republican Party has run in part on its strong national security credentials, or its putatively strong national security credentials, not just post-2001, but long prior to that. And that one of the claims when election rolls around, the Republican candidates, both for the White House and for Congress, will make is that the national security is better off in the hands of a Republican rather than a Democrat. The problem with making that claim today is that, on the one hand, with the exception of the major Nidal Hassan incident, there haven't been large terrorist attacks in the United States, either under Bush or under Obama. Moreover, whereas President Bush presided over what is arguably a series of very serious policy failures post 9/11, including the escape of bin Laden from Tora Bora, the Iraq War, one can compound the list. By contrast, President Obama presided over what many in the security services see as the successful operation that ended in the death of bin Laden. And so, lacking any substantively sound argument that this is an administration that has been that has failed to keep the nation safe, the Republican side has looked around for specious arguments that support its claim to being tougher on national security than the Democrats. One of those specious arguments is the one that animates the NDAA provisions at issue here, which is that how dare the president use Article 3 criminal process, footnote, Article 3 criminal process that President Bush repeatedly and uncontroversially relied upon for 7 years. The other strand of this is the kind of the racially or ethnically tinged claims about disloyalty of Muslims, right? Which is an insinuation that's been made about Obama generally, but we see playing out in the hearings run by Representative Peter King to the effect that, well, the Obama administration hasn't dealt with this serious fifth column problem of Muslims in the United States. Right. And we obviously see that in the Park 51 dispute and the like. So I think those two strands are both working and are both parts of the political strategy.
Well, Aziz Haq, the politics are one thing, but the law lives on. And it's very concerning to think that maybe there's language in there that was brought about by these partisan influences, and that then the president and others had to weigh in and put in language that kind of checkmated some of that language. And you may end up with ambiguity, which is what the head of the FBI was concerned about. I'm quoting him. The statute lacks clarity with regard to what happens at the time of arrest. You know, so it's a terrorist incident. The FBI shows up and then the military show up and then they have a fight over who takes who into custody.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that the consensus view of the intelligence and security services, a view that I, on this occasion, agree with, is that this statute will harm national security interests. and it's harmed national security interests. I think the only explanation an objective observer can give for that is that this was a statute enacted out of partisan motivations. It was enacted as a way of demonstrating that Republicans were tougher than President Obama on terrorism, and it has the consequence of making national security weaker. I don't think that that's anything. It's not terribly unusual, to be quite frank. I think that national security is often a political football, and I think that often the efforts of those who claim to be the toughest on national security have the net effect of weakening national security, because it's not the case. It's just simply not true that winning a war or a conflict of any kind simply involves the maximal use of force. That's just not how any kind of conflict is won.
So, Aziz Haque, if this new statute that's about to be signed into law and was earlier threatened with a veto by the president is bad for national security, the reason I'm calling you is it bad for civil liberties?
Well, I don't think that the Obama administration will. I think it's very unlikely that they will employ the statute in a way that has bad effects. But the problem, as you mentioned, is that statutes stay on the books after partisan arrangements change. And I do think one can look at the statute and see in it what Justice Robert Jackson once called a loaded gun waiting in the folds of the law for someone else to use. So yeah, I do think it's a loaded gun, and I would prefer to live in a world in which, you know, we don't have that kind of booby-trapped statute book or constitution. So yeah, I do think it's a bad thing, but it doesn't need to be the case for it to be a bad thing that the bad consequences arise today or tomorrow. They can arise 2, 3, 5, 10 years from now.
So just in closing, Aziz Haque, perhaps the partisanship is an explanation for what I find rather puzzling, that bin Laden's been killed. There's only a handful of these al-Qaeda people left in the mountains of Afghanistan and Pakistan. And suddenly, there's a greater terrorism threat than ever, which has to be responded to by diminishing or at least putting in jeopardy the basic liberties of this country?
I think that's absolutely right. I think that's absolutely right. You know, and I would further point out that, you know, this is coming from a led sort of caucus that on the Republican side that consistently fails to deal with what is plausibly a much graver strategic threat to the United States, which is global warming, which will have radical impacts and already is having radical impacts upon the security situation in places like South Asia, in places like China, and which we are not dealing with, which we are pretending doesn't exist. And that's, I think, in 30 or 40 years, people will look back and think, good grief, what were they thinking? And I think what they were thinking is they were thinking of, you know, winning the next election by scaring people with bogeymen rather than talking seriously about the interests of the United States.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Aziz Haque.
Okay, thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Aziz Haque, professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the co-author of Unchecked and Unbalanced, Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment.